US government's ability to really serve its citizens has been kneecapped for the private interests of a relative few. In a July 2017 poll by the Association Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, 75% of Americans believed people like them had too little influence in Washington, and 82% believed that the rich had too much power over the government.
I still say they are illegally running something in the United States of America. How dare they call this a democracy when it's not government for the people, by the people, but by an oligarchy, government controlled by the few. That's what the United States is.
Even the Trump administration, which claimed to be a voice of the people, championing their interests against a Washington elite, was the culmination of oligarchic rule, an administration totally at the service of arms companies, among others.
With every war, the ruling military, industrialist, oligarchs enjoyed phenomenal growth of their wealth and influence, while young Americans, mostly underprivileged and poor, would sacrifice their lives in the sinister cycle of killing and getting killed. All in the name of the universal values of freedom, democracy, and human rights.
In 2020, the Center for International Policy, CIP, released a report revealing that more than $1 billion had been donated to top 50 U.S. think tanks by U.S. defense contractors between 2014 and 2019. These think tanks play into the hands of the U.S. Defense Department's narrative with their reports and media releases. The political clout of billionaires has increased since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizen United decision, which determined that election spending regulations restrict the right of corporations to free speech. As for Biden, his promise to build back better has turned out to be an empty promise, and things are pretty much the same as before. His American Rescue Bill provides just enough relief to enable people to go back to living lives as economically stressed as they were before the pandemic. Even before the pandemic, 40% of Americans could not afford a $400 unexpected expenditure. A system that consistently makes it easier for the rich to get richer and harder for the poor to even make it at all is not called democracy. When the American citizens cannot seriously consider a 3% wealth tax on billionaires, yet cannot raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, they cannot call their ruling system democracy. When the three richest people in the US, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, own more than the bottom half of the country combined, doesn't oligarchy describe the system more accurately? All in all, the biggest divide in America today runs between oligarchy and democracy. When oligarchs fill the coffers of political candidates, they can be confident there will be no meaningful action against them and in favor of ordinary people. The U.S. political system has been widely but wrongly described as the one of the people, by the people and for the people. In reality, it is run by a group of oligarchs that make up the ruling class of American society. It is not owned or ruled by the people. It's just shouldered by the people.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed.
This Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وهو الذي أرسل الرياح بشرا بين يدي رحمته وأنزلنا من السماء ماء طهورا
And it is he who sends the wind as good tidings before his mercy, and we send down from the sky pure water.
لنحيي به بلدة ميتا ونسقيه مما خلقنا أنعاما وأناسيا كثيرا
That we may bring to life thereby a dead land and give it as drink to those we created of numerous livestock and men.
Brothers and sisters, we are now into the 49th verse of the chapter. لنحيي به بلدة ميتة ونسقيه مما خلقنا أنعاما وأناسيا كثيرا That thereby we may give life to a dead land and we give many beasts and men that we have created to drink of. This verse, dear listeners, is continuing what the previous verse was discussing. The 48th verse said, And he it is who sends the winds as heralds of glad tidings, going before his mercy, and we send down pure water from the sky. And this verse says why we are sending down pure water and rain from the sky, and what are the benefits of it. We know that this rain, this enlivening liquid, purifies our souls and our bodies altogether, And that is why in this verse we read, لِنُحْيَ بِهِ بَلَّةً مَيْتًا And thereby we may give life to a dead land, وَنُسْقِيَهُ مِمَّا خَلَقْنَا أَنْعَامًا وَأَنَاسِيَّ كَثِيرًا And we may give many beasts and men that we have created to drink thereof. In this verse, many beasts and men, أَنْعَامًا وَأَنَاسِيَّ كَثِيرًا are mentioned, though all of the animals and men use rainwater. This might be the fact that it is mentioned such because it wants to refer to those who dwell in desert and those who do not have permanent water and who cannot really use rainwater directly. They are the ones who perceive this important blessing more than other people do. So, when a piece of cloud appears in the sky and the rain falls, pits will be filled with clean water. Then, their animals drink water from them, and they themselves also use that water. They will perceive life. they will realize the true meaning of movement in themselves and in their domestic animals when they see raindrops falling out of the sky. Also, the word, the Arabic term nusqiyahu is used in this verse. لِنُحِيَّ بِهِ بَلْدَةً مَيْتَ وَنُسْقِيَهُ مِمَّا خَلَقْنَا أَنْعَامًا وَأَنَاسِيَ كَثِيرًا. And that we may give beasts and men that we have created to drink thereof. The Arabic word nusqiyahu is derived from the word isqa. As Raghib in Mufradat and other commentators believe, its difference from the word saqiya is that isqa means to prepare water and to let man to drink it whenever he likes, while the term saqi means to give someone a container of water for drinking. In other words, the word isqa has got an extensive meaning. It has got more meaning into it. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Another point regarding this verse is the fact that dead land is mentioned first, and then the beasts, and after that, men are brought up. At first it says, لِنُحْيَ بِهِ بَلْدَةً مَيْتًا, that we give life to the dead land, and then the word an'am, the beast, and then anasi, or the people. This is because when dead lands are not enlivened by rain, beasts also don't have food, when they are not fed, men cannot use them as food. Also, mentioning the enlivenment of water after the issue of purification may refer to their close relationship. In the previous verse, the discussion was about the purification of water, this function, and now how this water is used to enliven the dead lands. That is because the word tahur was used in the previous verse, and it can apply to something that is both very pure and purifier. About the word anasi that is used at the end of the verse, we can say that this word is the plural form of the word insi, which means man. And the last point regarding this verse to be mentioned is also about the order of the words mentioned. We first talked about why the dead lands is mentioned first, and then the beast, and after that, men. Let us have another look at this fact and say that in using water, we should rank agriculture first, and then there is the rank of animals, and then men. So in this verse, also, first agriculture of land, then animals, and finally men are mentioned. I assume we are done with this 49th verse of chapter Furqan. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program you will discuss issues, relevant questions and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Dear Sheikh, last time we spoke about this age, of the teenage age, and even the tweens phase, as you call it, when the children, they start to develop attractions to the opposite gender. Now, when we were talking about that, we also opened and discussed the subject of why is it that girls are more attached to their fathers, and also I think vice versa, perhaps the fathers are more attached to the children, the girls, and why is it that sons are more attached to their mothers? Now, we mentioned some things about personalities, how the personalities opposites attract to a certain extent. But I feel that there might be more to this subject. So, dear Sheikh, please.
Let me start from the other side first, because it gives a good clarity here. And then we will come to the children's side. If you look at the parent's side, that why is father more attached towards the daughter, is that the father knows that my son can protect himself, defend himself, take care of himself. However, somewhere deep down inside, the man does not have that confidence that my daughter can protect herself, take care of herself. Why? Because, again, a lot of daughters are sanguines, popular sanguines. So he notices their behavior in the house. He sees that, okay, she doesn't keep track of her books, she doesn't keep track of her shoes, she doesn't keep track of her clothes. Right. So she needs a protective figure.
He sees them as fragile.
Exactly. So I have to be there to protect her. I have to be there to take care of her. Now, being a father, being that macho and that aggressive and that, you know, strong personality, he can't express himself with that kind of authority in front of daughter. So with the daughter, being that strong personality, he acts, you know, nicely and fragile and, you know, patiently and caringly. And the daughter also likes that because at one end, she's getting all that care. On the other hand, she's feeling very secured and protected in the presence of the father. While she also notices that my mother, even my mother, when she wants protection, she goes to the father.
Right.
When she wants that support.
And comfort.
And that shoulder and that courage, she goes to the father. So she learns from the mother that I need to get to the father for that protection, for that security.
Makes sense. Right.
So this is how it works. The father has that sense of responsibility to protect the daughter. And the daughter, automatically looking at the mother, feels that need that if I want to feel protected and safe, I need to get to my father, and he's the person who's going to protect me.
What about the mother's attachment to her sons then?
Sons. Now, keeping in mind that father is not at home all the time.
Right, yes.
Right. And this is where the mother looks at the son as the next best option to be that protector of the house. And then the son also finds that joy and finds that satisfaction of being the protector of the family at home. So a boy who reaches teenage, I don't know, if you look at some of the earlier movies, you know, like there was a movie, if I am not wrong, it was Mel Gibson. The name of the movie was Patriot. He had a son about 10 years old, and it was a war between the Redcoats and Whitecoats in America.
Right. The Civil War.
Yeah, the Civil War. So he heads out in the war, and he appoints his 10-year-old son.
You're the man of the house.
You're the man of the house.
Yes, we still have this in our culture.
Exactly.
You're the man of the house when I'm not present.
Exactly. And what does this mean? You're the man of the house. Means that you are going to be the protector of the house. And mother looks at the son as the protector. And this is where the son feels that courage.
But even a small child who's only like 1 year old, two, five. even at that age, the mother's like, he's my protector.
Yes, to some extent, yes. The mothers always look at their sons as those who are going to be the protectors of the family.
At least going to be in
going
the future.
To, so right from that time, the mothers have a special attachment towards the son. And the son also gets all that love from the mother, which he doesn't get from the father. And that's why there's a special bond between the mother and the son here.
Let's continue this very intriguing conversation after a quick break.
Inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, just before we went on a quick break, you mentioned the reason
that a mother's more attached to her son is because she sees him as the protector of the family, or at least the future protector of the family. Correct. Now, Sheikh, is that always the case? Is that the sole reason why the mother is more attached to her son and why the father is more attached to his daughters?
Not necessarily. But rather, I would say the mother is more attached to all the children in a way, right, to a certain extent, equally, I would say. But somewhere, the son, being the son, has an upper hand compared to the girls in the house and can take care of a lot of chores, which are outdoor chores.
Right.
And that's where the mother, in a way, shows certain amount of dependency on the son.
She depends on the sons.
The
right.
son, and yes. the son likes the fact that I have someone who trusts me, who depends on me.
I have responsibility.
Right. She's treating me like a grown-up person, and he appreciates that, and he likes that environment, that I'm being treated like a man of the house every time my dad's
right.
not around.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So, and that gives that confidence to the son. And therefore, these are some of the various reasons why there's this special bond and attachment between the son and the mother and the father and the daughter.
Right. Sheikh, let's circle back to our original topic, which was, now that we've spoken about this phase, about all of these attractions, naturally when a child, he enters this teenage phase with all of the hormones and all of that stuff, which is natural, they start to view the opposite gender in a different light, in a different
Correct.
Way. They start to develop attractions.
Correct.
Which we've mentioned before, it can lead to a disastrous and catastrophic results.
Correct.
As parents, and especially for parents who live in Western countries where it is much harder to manage their children and an Islamic lifestyle, what can they do to protect their children so that they may grow up and handle this phase, navigate this phase in an Islamic way which pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Correct. Like you pointed out, when the son reaches, or even the daughter, whenever the child reaches that puberty and that teen age, because of the hormonal changes, there's certain behavioral changes in them. A lot of people frown upon these behaviors. So when they notice their son looking at the opposite sex and, you know, probably staring, they get upset that, oh my God, my son, you know, he's getting carried away. Or if a girl is getting attracted towards a good looking boy. But this is natural. This is a natural process. Now, there are ways to manage this scenario.
Let's scrap these scenarios after a quick break.
All right, great. Let's come back and discuss them.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, we were talking about how parents, they should manage this life phase of the teenagers when they start to develop feelings and are attracted just generally to the opposite gender.
Correct. We were mentioning about different scenarios or different possible methodologies that can be used to manage this kind of a situation.
Right.
First and foremost, I would like to point this out, that when a person is idle and he doesn't have enough work or task at his hand, this is when he gets this extra spare time to sit and think,
which right? is very dangerous,
which is superbly dangerous, and we have riwayats,
many narrations that are prohibiting, I would say, do not be idle, especially
exactly.
for youngers,
especially yeah. when you're in that stage
yes.
or teenage where all your hormones are on you know, steroids and going crazy,
yeah. completely yeah
yeah they're working hard, they're over yes. doing overtime, all your
yeah.
hormones
right.
And at this time, if your child is sitting idle and does not have tasks at hand
and alone,
and
especially
alone,
if they have their own bedrooms, their own telephone device, their own
exactly.
laptop.
This is another point that we're going to discuss in our subsequent episodes about having their own personal rooms and having
yes.
their own personal devices. Inshallah, we'll talk about that.
Inshallah.
But here, sitting idle is going to leave their mind empty. And this is where they start thinking. And when they start thinking, it leads them towards those thoughts about the opposite sex.
And then actions. And
exactly. So what do we do? One of the methods is not to let them be idle. Give them a task. Assign them tasks. Remember the age groups that we mentioned about. The first 7 years is the Sayyid, the kind of a...
Kind of the master.
The master of the house, or, you know, the explorer.
Yeah.
And then the second one was Abd, meaning the slave, the servant. And the third one was Wazir.
The minister or
exactly.
The
so
confidant.
Now when this teenage starts off and the child is at 14 years old, he's, according to the traditions, he's at that age of Wazir, meaning that he is now ready to accept tasks from you. Delegate tasks to him.
Responsibilities.
Give him responsibilities. Tell him shopping in your hand, lawn mowing in your hand, probably dishwashing in your hand. I don't know. Based on the gender that you have. You have a daughter, assign her the kind of things that she can take care of.
Outdoor work is generally for the
men, the boys, and the indoor work for the girls, you know, washing clothes or whatever. But assign them. Don't think that, oh, she's just 14, you know, why should I...
too young to learn to cook.
Exactly, and overburden her with tasks and all that. But if you're not doing that, then you're giving her a lot of extra free time to sit and ponder and think. And based on all the inputs that they're getting from the TV and from internet, from all the messages and the Instagram
posts.
Even the
foods that we eat.
Everything, even on your packagings, different food that you... And all those go into your brain as, subliminal messages to your subconscious mind. Right. And they contribute to what you think.
Of course, we should also mention that people who criticize some of these traditional ways of raising children, like teaching the daughters how to cook and the boys how to do outside work, how to go shop and buy stuff and do things, is a bad thing. But in reality, we are teaching them necessary life skills. We are investments.
We're teaching them how to be self-sustaining, how to be self-sufficient, how to be confident and, be independent in the future life.
In essence, yes. Sheikh, I would love to continue this discussion, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank you for contributing to this discussion and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Martyrdom of Imam Ali, peace upon him. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, Salam and welcome to the program. Heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on a very tragic day. In fact, today is that fateful day in history which saw the end of the only instance of the administration of social justice with the martyrdom of the commander of the all true believers, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the cousin, son-in-law, and divinely designated vicegerent of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before we present you a special program on the tragic 21st of Ramadan, here is Ayah 15 of Surah Hujurat, where God Almighty says, The true believers are only those who have attained faith in Allah and His Prophet and have never doubted, and who wage jihad with their possessions and their persons in the way of Allah. It is they who are the truthful. We are once again commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of the Barometer of Belief, the fulcrum of faith, the paragon of the pious, the epitome of eloquence, the byword of bravery, the manifestation of magnanimity, the symbol of sincerity, the jewel of justice, and the excellent exemplar of the administration the like of which the world has yet to see. The grand man who passed away on the grand night of Ramadan continues to transcend history and all historical developments, despite the passing away of a millennium and four centuries since the day when struck on the head by the poisoned sword of a cowardly renegade, while engrossed in the ritual morning prayer of the 19th of the fasting month, he expressed those immortal words: Fustu wa Rabbul Ka'bah, by the Lord of the Ka'bah I have triumphed. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, triumphed because, as the divinely designated heir of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, he drew the permanent line between the rule of the righteous and the misrule of the miscreants. Deprived for 25 long years of his right of political leadership of the Ummah, following the passing away of his cousin and father-in-law, the Prophet, he never harbored grudge against the usurpers. Whenever they came begging at his doorstep to resolve the problems facing the Muslims, he readily gave them the finest advice, to the extent that the second Caliph Umar ibn Khattab would say, "If not for Ali, I would have perished." When masses thronged his threshold to take over the caliphate, he refused, and when their pleas increased in view of the critical situation facing the Islamic realm, he reluctantly took up the reins of government to salvage the faith of Muslims, on condition he would rule only in accordance with the laws of God in the Holy Quran and the precepts set by the Prophet, rather than the un-Islamic innovations made by the previous three caliphs. Here is what he said on establishing the model government of social justice. By Allah, I had no liking for the caliphate nor any interest in government. But you yourself invited me to it and prepared me for it. When the caliphate came to me, I kept the book of Allah in my view and all that Allah had put therein for us, and all that according to which He has commanded us to take decisions. And I followed it and also acted on whatever the Prophet had laid down as sunnah. The famous exegete of the Noble Qur'an, Abdullah ibn Abbas, has narrated, "I saw Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, mending his shoes. I said, 'It is better you spend your time on repairing the social affairs.' He ignored me until he finished with his shoes and asked me how much the value of his pair of shoes was. I said that it had no value. He insisted that I may price it as it was. I said, 'Well, a fraction of a dirham?' Imam Ali, peace upon him, said, 'By Allah, this pair of shoes is more favorable to me than leading your political affairs, unless I can establish right and eradicate falsehood.' In one of his sermons, Imam Ali, peace upon him, elaborates on the concept of jihad, or striving sincerely in the way of God, which ought to inspire the spirit of resistance and the resolve to solve crises in contemporary Muslim societies, which are facing a variety of intricate plots from cultural, social, and economic to wars imposed upon them by the enemies of humanity, such as the Zionists and the US, as well as their minions, the Takfiri terrorists, modern day Khawarij, to which the Imam's assassin Ibn Muljam belonged. The Imam says, "Jihad is one of the doors of paradise which Allah has opened for His chosen servants. It is the dress of piety and the protective armor of Allah and His trustworthy shield. Whoever abandons it, Allah covers him with the dress of disgrace and the clothes of distress. Beware, I called you to fight these people night and day, secretly and openly, and exhorted you to attack them before they attacked you, because by Allah, no people have been attacked in the hearths of their homes, but they suffered disgrace. But you put it off to others and forsook it, till destruction befell you and your cities were occupied. You have become the target at which arrows are shot. You are being attacked, but you do not attack. Allah is being disobeyed, and you remain agreeable to it. When I ask you to move against them in summer, you say, 'It is hot weather, spare us, till the heat subsides.' When I order you to march in winter, you say, 'It is severely cold, give us some time till cold clears from us.' Alas, despite such words of wisdom, the Iraqis, because of their weak faith, failed to heed the admonishments of Imam Ali, peace upon him, and the result was calamitous for them and the other sections of the Ummah, not just through the seizure of the Caliphate by the Umayyad charlatan Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan, but by the several centuries of deprivation they continued to suffer well into modern times." The words of Imam Ali, peace upon him, are a warning to Iranian people, whom God Almighty rescued through Imam Khomeini from the despotic Pahlavi regime and the hegemonic Americans, that if the laws of God are violated, if the sunnah of the Prophet is ignored, and if the precepts of Imam Ali, peace upon him, and the other 11 infallible Imams of the Ahlul Bayt are set aside, on the misconstrued notion of progress on the patterns of the Deccan and West, then the result would be suicidal in the transient world and damnation in afterlife. Therefore, as Muslims, we ought to tread the footsteps of the person whom Prophet Muhammad likened to the Noble Quran, and who left for our guidance the lasting legacy of the rule of social justice. Thus, there are immortal lessons to be learnt, not just from the discourses, but from all the actions and deeds of Imam Ali, peace upon him, whose martyrdom we commemorate.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين. Welcome dear listeners to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program For Humanity and the segment is Hollywood, Conditioning of the Subconscious Mind and Extermination of the Human Rights. This is Sheikh Ali Hemani from Qom. So far we've been discussing about Milgram's experiment and the absolvents and the disruption of the free will of human beings. We discussed about how the media and the corporate world and the political world wants to control the free will of human beings. And we mentioned that there are three possible outcomes of any given society. Either they are predictable and they're not in favor, or they are predictable and they are in favor, or they are absolutely unpredictable. The most unfavorable scenario is that the group of people are absolutely unpredictable. So media, politicians, and corporate world does not like this kind of a group. They always want the people to be in the category where they can easily predict them. And the other added advantage is to have them in your favor. But a category of people who are predictable but not in favor are the Muslims, and they find it difficult to collaborate and to make things work and dictate terms to the Muslims. Let me take you back to the first episode that we discussed about, right, so that you can relate to the discussion we are having so far. The very first episode, we spoke about the human personality. We said human being has two dimensions to it. One is the body and the other one is the soul. And we mentioned that the human soul has three faculties to it. One is logic and intelligence. The other two are greed and anger, right? Islam says that maintain all your faculties at equilibrium. When you maintain all your faculties are at equilibrium, you are a very stable and organized person who can make the best decisions in the worst scenarios. But what does Hollywood want to do? They want to disturb this equilibrium. They want to disturb this equilibrium and take people out of that balance so that when this equilibrium is disturbed, they're not able to make the best decisions in the given scenario. What happens here is that the people end up taking decisions in a stressful scenario. Why? Because that stressful scenario is being created by Hollywood and the media. Most of the time, they want people to live an exaggerated life. They don't want people to live a balanced life. What do I mean by balanced life? A life where all our faculties, that is our logic, our greed, and our anger, they are at equilibrium and at a balance. They want us to live an exaggerated life where they want the greed to be at extreme. People wanting more, people asking more, people seeking more, even if it means causing harm to others. And when it comes to anger, they promote the idea that all problems can be solved with anger, with fist, with fighting, with putting others down. So Hollywood basically want us to exaggerate these faculties and not use them at a balanced level. And that's why you would see that most of the people, they behave or they emotionally, they are not balanced. They behave at an emotional disrupted state. They're not using their logic. They're not using their intelligence and common sense. Let's take a quick break, come back and discuss this further.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about the three faculties of human beings, and we were talking how the Hollywood promotes the idea of using them at an exaggerated level rather than maintaining them at balance. Let me give you some examples here so that you can relate to it. Let's look at some of the movies. I'm sure you must have heard of the movie called John Wick, and I'm sure you must have seen it. You must have also heard about Avengers. Let me give you an example of John Wick, then come to Avengers. In John Wick, you would see that right in the first episode, or rather the first movie, a bunch of guys walk into someone's house, they try to steal the car, and then they kill a dog, right? Now, four guys kill a dog. And in response to that, what does John Wick do? John Wick goes out seeking these four guys and killing hundreds of people who try and form that barrier or hurdle for John Wick to reach to these four or five guys. So what happened in the movie? The car got stolen, a dog gets killed. On the other hand, the reaction of John Wick is that he goes out killing hundreds of people just to take revenge for the killing of the dog. This is where the Hollywood is promoting this idea that if someone harms you, you go to that exaggerated level. You cross all the boundaries. You cross all the limits to take your vengeance, to take the revenge and prove your point that I'm the boss here. I'm the man here. I'm the angry one. And if you tickle me, I'm going to punch you bad. I'm going to come back to you dramatically with extreme force and extreme danger. And this is the message that is being delivered. Look at Hulk, the movie Hulk, right? Every time Hulk is put through a difficult scenario, that is Dr. Banner being put to a difficult scenario, he immediately takes a shape of Hulk. And when he's Hulk, all he knows is anger. He can't even frame a single grammatically correct English sentence. He just knows how to smash, how to break, how to beat. And sometimes he's even harming the innocent people around him without realizing that he is causing harm. So this is what I mean by saying that how Hollywood and Bollywood is causing us to behave at an exaggerated level, not allowing us to maintain our faculties, faculty of our aql, faculty of our greed, faculty of our anger at equilibrium, and live a life like a moral, ethical human being. They want us to live according to their terms. They want us to live according to their dictates. They want us to live like this. Now, imagine all that is being told to the religion, to the child upbringing, to the parents' behavior, and you will see that why our children are behaving in a particular way towards the parents. Because they are being dictated terms through these movies. They are being told, their subconscious mind, their faculties are being told not to behave at balance and equilibrium. Always react. Always exaggerate. So if your mom tells you something, go back and back answer her. Shout at her. Show her that you are the man in the house. React dramatically. And this is what the children are and teen are learning from different things that the media and corporate world is promoting. So they're basically dictating behavior to our children, to the teen, to the youth. Now, there's a big question here. The question is that someone might turn around and tell us that what's wrong with that? On one hand, the media and the corporate world is conditioning our subconscious mind and dictating terms to us. On the other hand, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is doing the same. Islam is also doing the same. It is dictating terms to us. It's dictating methods and rules and rulings and fatwa and halal and haram to us. So you have two entities dictating two set of information to us. So what's wrong with this entity that is media and corporate world dictating terms and things to us? Let's discuss this in our next episode. So until next episode, fi amanillah, God bless you all.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
We express our condolences first and foremost to the Imam of our time, Ajjal Allah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and to all the followers and lovers of Amirul Mu'mineen. We hope that Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala helps us be of those that are closer to true followers of Amir al-Mu'mineen. We've been talking about how Ali ibn Abi Talib is awwal madhloom. He is someone who went through and experienced a form of oppression, and his rights were violated in ways during his lifetime and afterwards in many ways. Part of that has to do with the way we, who claim to be following Ali ibn Abi Talib, not only loving him, we claim to be following him, are still not understanding what Ali ibn Abi Talib stood for. And we don't, while we claim we follow him, what we do doesn't match that. At times, it's a matter of weakness. After having known what needs to be done, like basic wajibat and salah, we know salah needs to be done. Amir al-Mu'mineen is the one who, in prayer, his connection with Allah was such that they took out the arrow or spear from his blessed leg or foot without him noticing that. He's someone that salah is a very important part of his life. We understand that, we know that. If we have deficiencies in that area, it really has to do with the struggle of trying to deal with the nafs and the desires, the temptations of, and forgetfulness, negligent of the time of prayer, and so on and so forth. Although that's not good and we should try our best, we should keep trying and bettering that, there's certain areas that not only do we not do, unfortunately, we sometimes support a view opposite that of Ali ibn Abi Talib while we claim we are Shia of Ali ibn Abi Talib. And that's what really hurts. That's what really bothers one.